This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Hitman's Bodyguard, Logan Lucky, Brigsby Bear, and In This Corner of the World. I'll also talk about the news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous home cinema roundup featuring The Descendants 2. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
It has been a crazy news week, and I normally don't talk politics because I'm not a political guy, but sometimes politics intersects with movies, and it intersected peripherally with movies this week with this Nazi KKK white supremacist rally that went on in which a woman was tragically killed. And the reason I bring this up is because this is a movie thing. I mean, this wasn't a movie thing, but most people who are younger than 70 know what they know about Nazis from movies and from television and from seeing stuff in entertainment fiction. And right now, I want to take you back to November of 2016, Thanksgiving weekend, when I was previewing in the trailer park The Zookeeper's Wife. And it launched me into this discussion that sadly seems to need to be repeated 8 months later. So I remember thinking a few years ago that there's a lot of movies made about World War II. There's even today. I mean, it's more than 70 years since the war ended. And you still get a lot of World War II movies. I mean, look, we even had Hacksaw Ridge. Just recently was a World War II movie. We got Allied this week coming out. That takes place during World War II. And I always thought it was kind of funny. I'm like, are we ever going to leave that behind? But I always said, you know, this is the thing that Hollywood always, you could always go to the Nazis as the bad guys. You always could. That you could be assured of not having to explain why the Nazis are bad and you can make them the bad guy in any movie. I mean, they even have the joke in Indiana Jones, one of the Indiana Jones movies, like, Nazis. I hate these guys. But somehow in today's world, in 2016, we now need to be reminded that Nazis were and are the bad guys. And this is not politics, even. This is not right or left. You can ask anybody on the right, on the left. You can ask people, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, progressive, independent, it doesn't matter. I think most people should agree. And they would agree. Nazis are and were the bad guys. But we got to be reminded of that. People need to be reminded that that kind of thinking is not good. No one's telling you you can't think that way. But you should not be raising your kids to think that way. And it's disrespectful in the extreme to the hundreds of thousands of Americans who lost their lives in World War II fighting in the European theater to let these bastards entertain some sort of modern incarnation that's remotely acceptable. Look, the Nazis are bad guys. Changing your name or your clothes doesn't change it. And this is not right versus left. This is a moral argument. Screw these Nazis. Where's Captain America to punch Hitler in the face when you need him? It's simple. If you're a Nazi, a KKK member, or a white supremacist, you are a bad person. If you march with Nazis, KKK members, or white supremacists, you are a bad person. If you support the Nazis, the KKK, or white supremacy, you're a bad person. If you excuse the Nazis, the KKK, or white supremacy, you're a bad person. And if you fail to condemn the Nazis, the KKK, and white supremacy, you are a bad person. Now, I get my therapy not from the medical field, but from movies. And after watching this absolute insanity that happened this weekend. It got me into thinking, what are some cathartic anti-Nazi and anti-white supremacist movies? So I want to just kick off the show here with a Fat Guy 5. Now, the first one, Indiana Jones, the whole series, but seriously, just really the first and the third movie, because those have the Nazis and the bad guy. And what does Indiana Jones have to say about them?
Nazis. I hate these guys.
Exactly. I just watched these a couple weeks ago with my youngest son, and they still hold up. They're still a lot of fun, and they unequivocally show the Nazis as the bad guys. The next one, Blues Brothers. Not a whole lot of people think of this movie as one that really takes on Nazis, but they do, because Jake and Elwood come up against a whole bunch of people in their mission from God, and here's what they had to say about Nazis.
Hey, what's going on?
Those bums won their court case, so they're marching today.
What bums?
The Nazi party.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
The third in the list, Inglourious Basterds. This is much more overt and obvious. And while I wasn't a huge fan of this movie, if the movie was wall-to-wall what's coming up here, what Brad Pitt says, I would have been a lot more into it.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Rain, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. We're going to be dropped into France dressed as civilians. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
The next one, Captain America, the First Avenger. This is the movie that popularized punching Hitler in the face, and that's a good thing. So here's the clip, and every time you hear the cymbals crash, I mean, this is radio, so you can't see it, but every time you hear the cymbals crash, we know what's happening. Finally, the last one, Porky's 2, The Next Day. This is not a great film. It's not as good as Porky's. But it does take on white supremacists. At least in this day and age, there's nothing wrong with watching a movie to cathartically release tensions about something in the news, even if it's not the best film. Here's a clip from Porky's 2.
We thought you might like to meet a friend of ours.
Yeah, I remember him.
you did a mighty fine job on him, Eustace.
That's a lot. They ain't happy. These engines ain't happy.
These are bad people. Shame on them. And shame on anybody who doesn't recognize that. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one is Molly's Game, which is written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, opens November 22nd.
I'm Molly Bloom. Do you know about me?
I read your indictment after I got your call last night, and I bought your book.
Do you understand that you are charged with operating an illegal gambling business?
Are you taking me on as a client?
I don't think I can convince my partners to take a flyer on the poke princess.
If you think a princess can do what I did, you're incorrect. I'm getting that you don't think much of me, but what if every single one of your ill-informed, unsophisticated opinions about me were wrong?
I'd be amazed.
I have a feeling this is going to be another one of those Jessica Chastain being a badass kind of character in the movie. Hey, look, you know, I didn't like her in Miss Sloan. I thought she was absurd in Zero Dark Thirty. This looks like it's going to get an award push, but not looking forward to this one. The next one, really quickly, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, who did The Lobster, also stars Colin Farrell.
Because we got the fire.
Don't be scared, Mom.
Yeah,
you'll see. You won't be able to move either. But you'll get used to it.
Where is she? What did you do to her?
We're going to let it burn, burn.
I don't understand why I should have to pay the price. Why my children should have to pay the price.
It's the only thing I can think of as close to justice. We can light it up.
I'm looking forward to this one. It looks creepy as all get out, and it looks bizarre. I thought The Lobster was an interesting movie, so I'm looking to see what happens here. That's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Brigsby Bear and In This Corner of the World.
We can't ignore it. There's a threat, and the war we must win.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews for this week. The first one I want to talk about is one that's kind of in limited release. It's finally hitting my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. So it's not going to be on any docket that you see. You got to kind of search for this in the theater. And that is Brigsby Bear. A man who is kidnapped as a baby is reintroduced to his real family, and to cope, he plans to make a final episode of the fake TV show his captors showed him as he grew up.
The reason you're here, the reason I'm here, is all just to help you.
Everyone says they're trying to help me, but nobody can find me the new episode of Brigsby.
There wasn't a new episode this week. This is about moving on with the rest of your life.
Try to imagine a hero.
Just be normal.
He's not on the bad side. He's on the good side.
There's always a rep at these movies who works for the studio, and they like to get comments. And I said, this is the weirdest sequel to Room that I've ever seen. I mean, I say that as a joke, because this really isn't Room, the one that Brie Larson won the Academy Award for. But it has that same idea of a person or a child who had been kidnapped and then kept for an extended period of time. The difference is in Room, the character knew for a fact that she was being kept hostage. The character in this one, he was picked up as a baby. They basically steal him out of a hospital when he was born, which is a terrifying thought. I remember when I had my kids, I remember quizzing the nurses on how they keep the kids straight, because I didn't want to go walking home with a different kid and not know. I mean, because, you know, it's your child, you know. At least the place I went to, the hospital we went to for our kids, they actually had some really intricate things in place to avoid this sort of thing. But this is kind of every parent's nightmare. But what's interesting about the movie is it's not told from a terrifying viewpoint. It's really more told from the guy's point of view. And he's grown up. He's in his early 20s. And all he knows is this family where he was kept in a bunker, and they're kind of bonkers, and they acted like they were in a post-apocalyptic world, like they'd have to go out in gas masks, and they created this weird little reality, and they basically produced this TV show once a week for years that he would then watch, and somehow it was supposed to bring some sort of significance, like it was a real show. So the character's not quite attached to reality, and the way he wraps his brain around things is by this character of Brigsby Bear, which is a kid's show that never existed. But these captors did. And one of the guy who plays his, quote, father, the father that he grew up with, who was a captor, is Mark Hamill. Which is it's actually a really great role for Mark Hamill, because it's not at all what you would expect. And especially for a man who was very popular with the Star Wars movies, but never really had any sort of success in terms of on-camera production after those. It's written, I believe, and produced by The Lonely Island, which you would expect something like Hot Rod, which is Andy Samberg and Jorme Taccone, as the people involved in this, but you see them show up here, but it's really it's a different movie. It's more of a drama, and it's a personal thing, and it's this weird little coming-of-age story for somebody who's way too old to be coming of age, but there's a real sweetness behind it. This is one of those movies that walks a really fine line, and it just barely makes it. You know, it's like there was that movie about the guy walking between the Twin Towers on a tightrope. He just barely makes it to the other side. But he does. Because this movie is charming, and it's heartwarming, and it's sweet. And you can't help but fall in love with these characters. Even though they're in, like I said, every parent's nightmare. they are living in a world which is quite literally horrifying, and stuff that's happened in real life with people who have been kidnapped and held in captivity. I mean, this is, but they kind of make it weirdly charming. Not his captors being charming, but his outlook, and it's strangely optimistic. And it plays around with nostalgia, and it plays around with fan fiction, and it plays around with that artistic spirit of wanting to create and wanting to get closure on something that meant so much to you as a kid. You know, we've all had TV shows that have gotten canceled that we didn't want to see end. And this is the ultimate one for this person. You know, there's some awkward moments, and there are some points where it really is in danger of toppling over and being a mess, but it manages to get through. And so I'm going to have to say Brigsby Bear kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about In This Corner of the World. Based on the best-selling manga, this story follows a girl growing up near Hiroshima during World War II.
I heard attacks on Mount Hagamine.
Evacuate!
Whenever you deal with movies from Japan that are animated, you have to understand how Japan looks at animated movies. In America, it's pretty much, if it's animated, it equals kids' movie. And every now and then we get a movie like Sausage Party, which is, it's overtly not a kids' movie. Or, you know, you got some TV shows, stuff like Family Guy and American Dad. Those are not for kids. And it is not uncommon to have animated series like on Adult Swim or whatever, but pretty much if it makes it to the major theaters, if it's animated, the average American thinks it's for children. In Japan, animation is just another medium of storytelling. I've seen many movies from Japan that there's nothing about them that says this has to be animated. I mean, yeah, you look at some of the Hayao Miyazaki movies, My Neighbor Totoro. You know, they're flying through the air, they're in a cat bus, and I mean, you would think, well, the special effects would have been expensive. You can just do this in animation, much cheaper. But there are other movies from Japan that would have just been shot with regular characters. This movie, you got the special effects of the planes flying overhead, because it's during World War II, so the Allies are bombing. But there's nothing that you wouldn't be able to achieve that you wouldn't have been able to achieve, you know, for 60, 70 years in movie making. But it's animated, and it's done so it gives a very beautiful touch, and it makes it very artistic. And it's the story of this girl as she goes along just through life, because she just basically lives on this small little farm. She spends time sometimes in Hiroshima, sometimes in Kure, which I believe is 20 some miles away. It's across the bay, so you can, because of course it's just Hiroshima, you know it's coming. When that happens, she can experience it, but she's not at ground zero. It's a very interesting movie culturally because it's Japanese and it's completely grown in Japan. It's the manga's from Japan, the animation and the movie. It's a Japanese film, and it gives the perspective not of the military, not of the political situation in Japan, but just of the people living there. Where you grew up, that's just the way it is. And what it was like during wartime. And while there's bombings and while there's stuff happening, life goes on, and they're not necessarily just all wrapped up in this war effort, which is sort of the skewed image that we often get, especially over decades of the presentation of the Japanese people by American and European filmmakers. So it's a really unique approach to the story. It's impressive. And it's opening in something like 50 theaters around the country. It's not huge. It's not a huge opening. And most of them are playing it with Japanese language and English subtitles. But you can find a couple of them that are dubbed if that's your thing. But overall, I'm going to have to say In This Corner of the World kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Hitman's Bodyguard and Logan Lucky. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse, Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews for the week. The new movies, these are the big ones that are coming out, the bigger ones. The first one is The Hitman's Bodyguard. An elite bodyguard falls from grace and has to protect a hitman who has tried to kill him many times before so he can testify at The Hague.
The trial continues.
One of the world's most brutal dictators.
With a key witness to testify.
Kincaid is dead. You'll be paid in full.
There's a safe house not far from here.
I have a job for you.
The transport is in there.
What the?
27 times. That's how many times they tried to kill me. 27. 28!
This is one of those films that actually exists in two separate genres. It is a bona fide action movie. It's got all the stuff for an international action movie, kind of a James Bond type movie. You've got plenty of bullets flying. You've got action sequences and car chases, a lot of really big deal stuff. So it doesn't feel like it's skimping on that action, but it's also a comedy. And it's 100% a comedy. It doesn't try not to be a comedy from the beginning. Sort of, and let's use Ryan Reynolds as sort of the connecting factor here. It's kind of like Deadpool. Deadpool is an absolute comedy, but Deadpool also works as an action movie. They don't skimp on that. They still have him doing the sword fighting and everything in that movie. And in this one, you get the same thing. The only thing is he doesn't regenerate and he doesn't have a red hood. But you get that with this movie because it's absurd and fun and over the top, but it also has Ryan Reynolds snarking and sniping through the whole movie, but somehow it works for both. It doesn't feel like it's a conflicting movie. It's an action comedy. And Samuel L. Jackson, while he's not necessarily known for comedy, he certainly delivers on a lot of the points in this film. And that's because he's sort of the foil to Ryan Reynolds' often played character of trying to be too perfect and failing and then getting really sour about the whole thing. And you ultimately get the two of them fighting each other in terms of just having to deal with each other. And in a lot of ways, it works as a buddy cop film. Only it's not a buddy cop film. It's sort of the antithesis of it because they're not cops. But ultimately, The Hitman's Bodyguard has some just fantastic action sequences. I mean, near the end, there's this part in the third act. I will warn you about this. It's a little heavy-handed. They go a little too far with the action on this one. There's stuff that happens in here, especially in light of recent events. And by not recent events, I'm not just talking about certainly recent events in the last couple days, but recent events in the last couple years. There's things that happen that you don't feel are fun to watch. And it kind of reminded me of when there was that movie, it was one of the Step Up films. I don't remember which one it was, but it came out right after the shooting in the late night screening of The Dark Knight Rises. And there's a scene where these people throw they're a dance troupe. And so the way they get on stage is they throw smoke bombs and they come in gas masks, which was kind of uncomfortable to watch in the theater, especially very recently after the Dark Knight shooting. So you have a little bit of that, especially near the end, but they get around it fast. And once they finally get past that moment, it is a little more enjoyable. But overall, I mean, the action's fun. I would call this movie fun, except for the bits near the end, which are a little uncomfortable to watch. But overall, it's entertaining, and it's sort of like Atomic Blonde, where Atomic Blonde, you can't take it too seriously because it's such an absurd movie. But it's certainly fun to watch the action, and that's what you get with this movie. On the flip side, it is a comedy, and it does sort of squander some of the dramatic elements, but all those dramatic elements are all cliche anyways. And it made me laugh, and it was fun to watch. And it was entertaining. And that's what you need, especially nowadays, right here in the dog days of summer. You're in the end of August where everything's falling apart. and there's no big, huge, exciting movies to see. This is a nice little, it's a little bit refreshing. So I'm going to have to say The Hitman's Bodyguard kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Logan Lucky. Two brothers in West Virginia plan a heist of the NASCAR Motor Speedway in Charlotte after falling on hard times.
You were just fired.
I was let go for liability reasons involving insurance.
Charlotte Motor Speedway. I know how they move the money.
The Coca-Cola 600 is the biggest race of the year.
They're gonna know what we want them to know. My life of crime is over.
I have spoken at great length the last couple weeks about how Hollywood will sometimes not screen movies or not screen them widely. And I know a lot of times, especially now more than ever, you can judge the studio's confidence in a film by how widely they screened. Great example last week. They did some screenings for The Glass Castle, but they didn't do many. And they did no screenings for The Nut Job. Neither of those movies did well. Those movies bombed. After seeing how they performed, you're like, oh, no wonder they didn't want this. They didn't get good reviews. And while I still contend that there's not that one-to-one relationship between good and bad reviews and the success of a movie, good reviews can certainly help a movie. You're never going to hurt a movie with good reviews. But I mean, sometimes you just have a terrible movie and bad reviews or good reviews aren't going to help it. But if you look at something like, Annabelle Creation, they certainly had confidence behind that one and they got good reviews. And that, I think that helped give it a little more oomph at the box office. It didn't make or break the movie, but it helps. Now, Logan Lucky had limited screenings and it is doing extremely well in terms of the opinions of the art house critic. There's a lot of people who just love Steven Soderbergh no matter what he does. I'm a little iffy. I've loved some of his movies. I thought some of his movies were fantastic. Stuff like Traffic, Aaron Brockovich. The Ocean's movies are quite fun. And in a lot of ways, he's trying to build this as a hillbilly Ocean's 11. It's not really that. It's much more dry. Part of the thing with Ocean's 11 was very accessible, very mainstream. It popped. It had a real energy to it. And this one does at times, but there's other times where it really drags. It's got a great cast. I mean, Channing Tatum's very good in the movie. Adam Driver's very good in the movie. They're the brothers. Daniel Craig's fantastic in the movie. He plays a demolitions expert who's in jail, who they want to break out of jail to help them do this heist. It's got Seth MacFarlane in an odd little role. Sebastian Stan. Hilary Swank's in it, although she doesn't show up until near the end. When her character finally shows up, the movie goes completely off the rails and doesn't know how it wants to wrap things up. It's kind of a mess. So while it has elements of the Ocean's movies, it just doesn't have the same punch and excitement to it. And it, on the one hand, he's also trying to sort of deal with the plight of people living in an area where, let's just say that West Virginia, I got family in West Virginia. West Virginia has fallen on some hard times with the phasing out of the coal industry, regardless of what's happening in the national scene. There are a lot of people on hard times in West Virginia. And I will say this, the movie does a pretty good job at not being overly stereotypical with the character. I mean, there certainly are stereotypes in this movie. There certainly are exactly what you would expect from a trendy Hollywood director trying to conceptualize what people in West Virginia look. And it does kind of fall at a lot of times into stereotype, like especially his henchmen, like the people he works with. But like, I mean, ultimately, the characters of Channing Tatum and Adam Driver, they're not absurd buffoons. They're just average people, and they don't make them redneck hillbilly idiots, which you would normally, they have the redneck hillbilly idiots in the movie. So they do play with the stereotypes in a not so flattering way to Wild and Wonderful West Virginia, but the movie does avoid that at certain times. But the best part about it are the actors and their performances. They do a great job, even when the movie drags. And it drags at times. This movie could have been 20, 30 minutes shorter. And it's clearly Soderbergh wrestling with a very popular mainstream idea, but trying to wrap it around a more of an art house approach. But I guess that kind of works in terms of the marketing. Anyways, I'm going to have to say Logan Lucky. I'm going to actually put it as a kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to have a throwback review of Welcome to Leith, the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup featuring The Descendants 2. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Left me a mule to ride.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with the movie reviews. I'm actually going to do a throwback movie reviews. I know this is I'm sort of grinding this theme into the ground, but I think this is important. This goes kind of kicking back to the first segment where I was talking about white supremacist, and it brought up something that, you know, while I had to dip into the archives and pull out that bit about the Nazis from almost a year ago, I'm dipping into the archives again and pulling out a movie review for a film not a whole lot of people have seen. I reviewed this almost exactly 2 years ago, back in September of 2015, and it's called Welcome to Leith, and it is worth hearing again. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Welcome to Leith. A group of white supremacists attempt to take over the government of a small town of only a couple dozen people in North Dakota.
When he first got here, he turned around and asked me, did we have any land for sale?
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
This is a fascinating story on many different levels, and it's one of the better documentaries I've seen this year, mainly because it does a really good job at being out of the argument. A lot of times in documentaries, people are obviously coming with a standpoint. And I mean, it's clear that the people who made Welcome to Leith are not fans of the white supremacists, which is a good thing because those people are bonkers. But they don't get overly judgmental. They show the footage and they let the footage speak for themselves. And when this guy, Craig Cobb, is running around yelling racial and insults at people and walking around town with an automatic weapon, And causing problems, that speaks for itself. So you don't have to work to make that guy look like a nut job or the people he's with. His sort of his sidekick is the walking, talking stereotype of what you would expect a white supremacist to be. It's a fascinating movie because it's true. This really happened. It's a town and there's like 24, 26 people who technically live there in the town limits. So it has a mayor. But it doesn't have a police office. I mean, it has the sheriff, the county sheriff covers them. But that's it. Just like a couple dozen people, including the children. And so what the plan was to go to this town, have more white supremacists move in, and eventually just populate the town. All you needed was, you know, six or seven families, and boom, suddenly you have a voting majority. And that's terrifying because what they were doing was not illegal. Now, of course, you would have to play this out in your head. If they were successful in this, local law can't trump federal law. If the federal law says you can't discriminate, they can't suddenly say, well, in Leith, we're going to say you can't live here if you're black. You can't do that. There are certain federal laws that are not left up to the states or local municipalities. So there would be lots of problems. The people there didn't want anything to do with this group of folks, but, you know, they legally purchased the property and they legally started to move in. And it's this interesting chess game of how to get them out, but also not violating what they stand for anyways, because after all, they want to get rid of these people because of who they are and what they believe, which is kind of what the white supremacists want to do. I'm not equating them. I'm not saying that they have the same level, but the point being is a white supremacist doesn't like people because of their beliefs and because of who they are. And you can't make laws in that local town to say, well, we can't have you here if you're a white supremacist. You can't be a thought police to them. You can't say you can't be here if you're a white supremacist. Like I said, it's a little bit of a chess match of how they dealt with this problem because they couldn't violate the law themselves. You can't stop somebody from buying property. So, you know, looking at loopholes and that sort of thing. Ultimately, what it is these people are very scary people, but they're not terribly clever. And the last thing you want is a crazy whack job who's very, very clever. Because this guy's not clever. He thinks he's clever. He thinks, and he's smart. Apparently, he's got a real high IQ, the guy who orchestrated this. But he's kind of an idiot. Because if he was really smart, he would have moved in, been very quiet about it, had other people move in, had them be very quiet about it, and then, boom, then show your colors and take over the government. But you weren't able to do that because he couldn't hold himself back. He had this great plan and it could have worked, but he was too much of an idiot to really make it work. And you can see that crumbling from the beginning, but it's terrifying to watch. It's a fascinating documentary. And like real life, it doesn't have any sort of easy answers. So it's not terribly satisfying when you get to the end, but that's life. That's the way it is. I mean, you can always Google search Leith, North Dakota, and you'll come up with the story, and you're going to know what happens in the movie. But it's definitely worth seeing because it puts you in that position of what would you do? Also, keep in mind that there's no real crime that's been committed. So I'm going to say Welcome to Leith totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Welcome to Leith is available on demand and on DVD and on Blu-ray now. It is absolutely worth watching, especially in the climate of today. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quick about the box office. Was I correct? The winner, I said that Annabelle was going to win, and I was right. I don't think a whole lot of people were dismissing that idea, and it did better than some people were predicting. It ended up making $35 million over the weekend, which was exceeded the $30 million or slightly under $30 million preview that people were having. Dunkirk came in second with 11, but then The Nut Job 2 came in with just over 8, and The Glass Castle came in with 4.5. I mean, it just, these movies sunk, not because they were necessarily getting bad reviews, but they were bad movies, but also they didn't promote them the way they probably should have. This week, I think it's going to be kind of a horse race between The Hitman's Bodyguard and Annabelle, right around $15 million, with Lucky Logan pulling in third. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Real quickly, I want to talk about the spotlight this week, and that is The Descendants 2. In this sequel to the Disney Channel hit, the children of the fairy tale villains return to their island to fight against Ursula's daughter, who kidnaps the prince.
Everybody wants me to be this lady of the court, and I have no idea how to keep up the act. Mal's gone back to the isle.
I'm back.
That little traitor who grabbed everything she wanted and left me nothing.
When I get my chance to rain down the evil on Auradon, I will take it.
This is my fault. I have to go there and apologize.
Where's Ben?
Uma captured him.
If you want Beastie Boy back, bring me Fairy Godmother's magic wand.
If you don't watch the Disney Channel and you don't have kids, this is probably completely off your radar. But this is following in the traditions of Disney doing these sort of like musical movies that are on the Disney Channel. They've really built it up. They've had a big push with High School Musical like 10 years ago that sort of reinvigorated this type of film, and of course Kenny Ortega, who worked on those, directs this as well. And they did that with Camp Rock. They had a sequel to that. Now they've got The Descendants, which they did The Descendants, I think, 2 years ago. And this is the sequel. And this is completely playing off the Disney characters. I mean, it's playing off of all the villains and the heroes. They've got Mulan's kids and Belle and the Beast's kid, and they've got Maleficent's daughter and the Evil Queen's daughter. Ursula's daughter is the bad girl in this one. And these are fun, disposable movies. I mean, it's made for like 10 and 11 year old kids. That's who it's aimed for, and particularly girls, because this is that part of the Disney brand that is very much made for the girl counterparts, very much like High School Musical was. Whereas that's part of the reason why Disney picked up Marvel and Star Wars, is so they could have sort of like the more boy-centric stuff You know, even though that's gotten them into trouble with gender politics today. But this film certainly works on the style and the look, and it's kind of a different take to on the Disney Princess, because Disney Princess, I think, has been just kind of ground in the dirt. I think we had enough of Disney Princess. And this is taking the bad girls, the bad characters, and it's not all girls. You've got, like, Cruella de Vil's sons in it. And it's a cute little clever approach to the movies, and I had a lot of fun watching. It was funny. I babysit my cousins, who are 3.5 and 2, and I had them over, and I was just watching it because I needed to watch it, and they were enthralled in this movie. And like the 3-year-old, his mom comes to pick him up, and he's like, "Oh my, they're sword fighting, and they're on a pirate ship, and there are dragons and octopus," and he was all excited. He loved that movie. And I have to say, you know, Disney knows what it's doing when it comes to making a movie for kids. And there's a couple special features. There's like an interviews with the kids, and there's deleted songs and deleted scenes, and they've got sort of like these 5-minute episode animated series that spin off of these characters. So we've got that on the DVD, which just came out this week. So I'm going to have to say that The Descendants 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The other movies this week that are on DVD include The Wall, How to Be a Latin Lover, Riverdale Season 1, and The Blacklist Season 4. That's it for this show. I will see you all next week when I talk about Birth of the Dragon, Leap, and All Saints. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.